Hello, everybody in the entire universe. I think I'm John Atack today, probably. Do I look like John Atack, do you think?
You look like John Atack, but
Yeah, see, John Atack looks like various things, Rowan Atkinson being one of them. And this is Spike
And I
Robinson.
know I'm Spike Robinson.
Yeah, she's pretty
Well,
sure.
one a Spike Robinson. I am not the deceased legendary saxophone player from Chicago.
I'm pleased to hear that because I have problems having conversations with deceased saxophone players. I don't know what it is, but when I tried to talk to Lester Young the other week, he was just incredibly non-responsive. So the press.
Yeah, well, you know what Mozart's doing now.
Go on. This is your
Decomposing.
decomposing. Yeah, I was thinking of that word the other day, and how silly it is. This is a terrible bad start because we're going to
This
talk
is
about
terrible.
something incredibly serious. I've been accused of being flippant, and I am. And you have to excuse that I have a certain degree of dark gallows humor because I have experienced a tremendous amount of trauma in my life, and so I think I have the privilege of laughing at and ridiculing Ron Hubbard and Scientology because
I'll
of.
say it right away. If you can't laugh, laughing is to take power over something and to change it and to highlight it as the ridiculous thing it is. And sometimes it's much better to laugh than to cry.
But it's not necessarily appropriate in the courtroom
No, it
or
is
when we're
not.
discussing,
We're at a
horrible things that people have done. So I'll try to be good, but I probably won't manage. Okay, our topic for today is slavery. And I just want to remind anybody and everybody that cares to listen that there are currently in the world somewhere over 40 million slaves. This is according to the United Nations. This is more than there have ever been in history. So, it's absolutely right that we should, look at the awful history of slavery, and particularly of the African slavery and the Irish and Scottish slavery, which the British contributed to, and back through to Celtic and Saxon slavery and Roman slavery and Greek slavery. All of these forms are really important to understand. But the most important thing is to liberate people who are currently enslaved. And at the moment, I would estimate that there are about 4,000 slaves in Scientology's Sea Organization. So in 1952, when offering people a doctorate for listening to him for 6 weeks, and I think you deserve a doctorate listening to Ron Hubbard for that long, doctorate in patience, perhaps, Ron Hubbard said, you can control men like you would control robots with those techniques, meaning Scientology. We've got some new ways to make slaves here. So Ron Hubbard admitted that Scientology techniques can be used to enslave people. It's him that put that view forward. And I would say they have been used for that purpose. And the current situation is, for those 4,000 people, is that they don't have control over their own lives. They don't choose what to eat. They don't choose when to sleep. They don't get enough sleep. They don't get adequate nutrition, suitable nutrition. They're not allowed to have children. If they do, they're sent to the outer organizations as punishment. And they're, I've talked with women who were bullied intensively over a period of one told me for 2 weeks every day throughout the day every day to have terminations, to have abortions. So that's an aspect of the control. They are sent, they have to do the work they're told to do. They give over the locus of control, as psychologists say. So to be a healthy adult, you need to have at least some control over the circumstances of your life. And when somebody else controls your sleep, your food, I talked with a woman who had spent 20 years in the Sea Organization. And she'd worked for David Miscavige at Golden Era Productions, Gilman Hot Springs in California. And she told me that she would normally sleep 2 hours a night. This is not adequate to actually maintain the human body. It will kill you, given enough time. She said 5 hours was a really good night. She normally slept on a piece of foam rubber underneath her desk so that she could get straight back to work after her 2 hours sleep. She had a horrific marriage and her husband was physically violent, but he was never put into ethics because he had high statistics on his post. So he was what's called Car Khan. He was a power stat. And so he could beat this poor woman up, knock her to the ground, leave her battered and bruised, and suffer no consequences because he was considered to be highly ethical because he was making money for Scientology. Now, as it happens, she managed to get away from that relationship and she met a man in this organization who she fell deeply in love with. And for 3 years, they were married. And then she decided that being in Scientology was going to kill her, that there was no way of surviving what was happening to her. So in that three, she decided to leave Scientology and the relationship. And I was there when she said goodbye to her husband, which was extremely traumatic because I got to sit with Ken Hodan, who was then the port captain or head of espionage, intelligence, and harassment for the international headquarters. And he got very upset with me and looked as if he was going to punch me, which I'm not very keen on. I'm being flippant again, aren't I? I'm not keen on being punched. What is wrong with you, John? Why do you have to make a joke out of everything? I don't know. It seems to work for me. But she told me that in 3 years, she and her beloved husband had 3 days leave together, 1 day a year. So even the African slaves in New Orleans were allowed to go to Congo Square on a Sunday and play drums. So they got a little bit of time off. Of course, we shouldn't make any, it would be invidious to make any direct comparison to the African slaves and the awful treatment they received.
Nonetheless, those were probably just the house slaves within the city. It would have been a totally different thing to be in one of the field slaves out in farmland.
It varied from one plantation to another. Yeah. And
just
and,
like anything, your results will vary.
There's Thomas Thistlewood's journals show you what the most extreme treatment was. But you know, it was variable, but it was not good.
No.
The point is in the C organization, you'll often go for weeks working a 90-hour week and not being allowed to do anything. Now, many of these slaves have escaped and very few of them have dared to do anything.
No,
to speak out against their slavery.
And that's one point I want to mention, because you're talking about a lot of the physical aspects, not being able to sleep, choose your own life. But then there's also a further slavery that I've experienced as a human being, but you fortunately have not, of being enslaved in mind, where even your thoughts are not your own. Their thoughts belong to David Miscavige and to some lesser extent, I believe, to Hubbard and to the overall group of Scientology. Even your thoughts, you cannot have the privacy of your own thoughts. You can't have an idea and go, oh, wow, that's a great idea, or sit and daydream. You have to always be thinking of whatever I don't know how to express it in Scientologies. In my own group, it was the mission. You always had to have your thoughts.
The purpose.
Focused. Yeah. Purpose. You always have to have your thoughts focused on what the leader wants you to focus on. So you can't even have your insides are all.
There's no freedom of thought. There's no freedom of mind.
Yeah.
And taking away freedom of mind is the fundamental of slavery, of a really despicable and overwhelming form of slavery.
Well, that if today, if you and I went with, say, a small contingent of armed soldiers to Gold Base and said, okay, folks, you are free, a lot of them would choose to stay.
All
because they believe they have to in order to save the world.
Clear the planet.
Short story to just say how enslaved somebody can be. One time while I was enslaved and I was married off to a guy, we were in a park. He pushed me down. A bunch of guys came because some guy was pushing a woman down. So they wanted, and they were going to beat him up. I broke a bottle open on a railing and stood between them and my abuser saying, if you want to hurt him, you have to go through me. Because my mind was captured to the point where I believed I had deserved that shove.
And you aren't the sort of person that we associate broken bottles with as a means of defense. You know, that sounds quite out of character, really.
It was out of character, but at the time, I was not me.
And no, and that's the point of slavery, isn't it? Yeah. That you don't have control over, you know, what you think and what you do.
Yeah, these people in the Sea Org, they are not them. They are slaves for the Sea Org. And even if went in and tried to rescue them now, their thoughts are not enough their own. There might be some who are planning to escape tomorrow, but there's a whole bunch more who haven't gotten to that point yet.
Well, Lawrence Wright, in Going Clear, wonders why it was that when the largest raid in the FBI's history, July 1977, that in Los Angeles, the Rehabilitation Project Force people didn't leave. So he saw them as being captives, but he didn't understand that it was not physical captivity that was going on here. This is psychological slavery. And
the
that is
the prison of mind.
The prison of mind. That is the point of Scientology. You know, whatever it represents itself to be. Hubbard claimed that he was going to increase people's self-determinism, their ability to make decisions for themselves, to work things out for themselves. And yet, when you sign up for the Sea Organization, you sign a contract which has attached to it the code of a Sea Org member. And the code of a Sea Org member, and of course you're signing for 1,000,000,000 years of service. And during that 1,000,000,000 years, I mean, I'd have a problem just doing 1,000,000 years, 1,000,000,000 years. I mean, it's very extreme. So that code says, I promise to uphold, forward, and carry out command intention. And so you sign up for 1,000,000,000 years of servitude, of slavery. And this is kind of glossed over. So I want to talk a little bit about how this came about. The end of 1966, L. Ron Hubbard had a bout of bronchitis. Now, this happened pretty much every winter, and he attributed it to mysterious reasons. So the bizarre and peculiar course called the Glearing course, which is pretty much out of use, has been out of use since the late 70s, but that came from a bout of bronchial pneumonia in 1965. And then OT3, operating Thetan level 3, the wall of fire, the great discovery of how our reactive minds had been made 75 million years ago by the evil Prince Xenu. This was his solution to his bronchitis. Now, as L. Ron Hubbard says, the suppressive person always blames the wrong target. And I think smoking 100 cigarettes a day probably had more to do with his bronchitis than the clusters of body thetans that he got from Xenu and his mates. There is a little episode there. I'm sorry?
Unfiltered cools, yeah?
Yes, and ultimately Picoons, which were made in New Orleans because cools were not strong enough. Then the last few years of his life, about the last 3 years, he stopped smoking and he's got into his 70s. The thought that a man who was that badly addicted to cigarettes, and he used to say to messengers he wished he could quit, the thought that somebody who is that badly addicted to cigarettes should be the founder of Narconon, which cures addiction, there are some paradoxes that surround Scientology.
Or claim to say that you can have total intention over your mind, just follow what I say.
Yeah, when you are OT8, you will be at cause over physical and mental matter, energy, space, and time. He reckoned he developed that in, I think, 1971, when he used it on Otto Roos, who had an interesting career thereafter. We won't get into that here. But he claimed that he had achieved this, and he most emphatically had not. So he carried on smoking. He carried on getting bronchitis, and he carried on coming up with lunatic cures. It may well be that his illness in 1977, which provoked the new era Dianetics for operating thetans, NED for OTs, or which was to become operating thetan level 5, when all of the operating thetan levels that had been meant to be about being outside of your body and controlling things and making things happen, they were all dropped. 1978. They're all gone, folks. They didn't work anywhere. I've interviewed plenty of people that did them. And they were largely, and here's a big secret, processes that came from the 1950s books. So sorry about that. You can find them on the internet if you want to waste your time doing such things. So here he is. He's in Gran Canaria, one of the islands of the Canary Islands, which are Spanish possessions, 200 miles off the coast of Morocco. And very nice. I've actually been to Gran Canaria. It's a lovely place. Lanzarote was a bit funny because it's all black because it's volcanic. And that was quite cute. It's like being in a landscape covered in coal. Very, very, very strange. But Gran Canaria was great. And you can see the house where Christopher Columbus stayed, or Christopher Colon, to give him his proper name. Shitbag. Sorry, this is what it means. And that huge macaw there when I went there. It was very scary. Great big, huge parity type thing. But this is where OT3 was developed. And of course, Hubbard says that the volcanoes of Lanzarote and there were two places where Xenu had spirits dropped into volcanoes and blown up with hydrogen bombs, which seems like overkill to me, I must say. And one of them was Hawaii and the other was the Canary Islands, where he happened to be. Now, just a little historical fact here, that these islands didn't rise up from the sea until 9 million years ago. So he's got his date wrong by 66 million years. And if you don't get the date right, he didn't know about Pangaea and all of that kind of stuff. It's all too complicated for him, I think. The shifting of continents. Poor man. I think he also got, and this is absolutely an aside and irrelevant, he got the date wrong because he was writing this at the time that the Great Extinction was discovered in the 60s. And it was misdated initially to 75 million years ago. And then it was redated to somewhere between 60 and 65. And if you get the date wrong, the incident won't run. If you get the location wrong, the incident won't run. So I'm suggesting OT3 is nonsense. What a terrible thing to do.
For the watchers at home who aren't fluent in Scientology.
Lucky enough not to be.
Could you please translate the incident won't run?
Right. But the idea is that we are impaired by having traumatic incidents which have an action, an invisible action upon us. We are not aware of the content of these things, and they make us think things and do things. It's kind of an elaboration of the unconscious mind, which of course Freud didn't invent. It had been around as a concept when he was born, but he did rigidify it. And this idea that there's an invisible agent inside you that's making you do things, a separate mind, an unconscious or reactive mind. Hubbard then elaborated that to body thetans, or little spirits that are having their thoughts and making you do stuff. This is all nonsense. There's nothing. There's no one else inside you, folks. There's no unconscious mind. They're unconscious processes. But there's nobody in there going, oh, I'm going to get you. This is childish. And it's found in all sorts of psychotherapies and religions and what have you. Sorry.
Unless you have a tapeworm.
Well, yeah, but it's not thinking for me, generally.
That's true.
Of course, I have a tremendous, I have not just bacteria, viruses, bacteriophages, fungi, even possibly archaea living inside me, and quite a lot of them. But they don't make my mind up.
This is true.
Even the idea that some have touted that the gut microbiome is what determines your mood is questionable. It may influence your mood, but I don't think it determines your mood, you know, and so, you know, get happy. Stop being miserable. It's not your microbiome's fault. And stop eating all that ultra-processed food, but we won't get into that. So an incident is an experience that you've had which was traumatic and which is having an influence upon you now. So in OT3, you run incident 2, which is meant to have happened 75 million years ago, and you were captured on one of 176 planets, brought to the Earth, which was called Tigiak, or the Jerry Armstrong Corporation, as when you open those, that out, Tigiak, Jerry Armstrong Corporation. That was one of Jerry's little jokes. Bless their lovely man. Did so much to help people, has done so much to help people. Brought to Tigiak, to the Earth, dropped into volcanoes, blown up on, and there are pictures of this. The 1968 and onwards book covers actually have pictures of what happened in the, so Dianetics, the Evolution of a Science, has men in white uniforms loading boxes onto what looks like a DC-8 aeroplane.
Well, you know, you remember, I'm sitting less than 6 feet from my own representation of it that I made in faux stained glass paint. I should probably put some pictures of it on the screen.
We'll be raffling that at a later date.
I would love to give it to a decent home. I'm sick and tired of it on my piano.
Well, anybody that's got some money, you know, we're accepting bids.
Yeah.
The idea is that the spirits of, yeah, huge amount of people and beings were dropped into volcanoes on Hawaii and the Canary Islands, which didn't exist at the time, then gathered up on electronic ribbons, whatever they are, and implanted for 36 days. And the implants contained Christianity, which Hubbard said was invented in these implants. He also said it was invented in 600 BC by the Nestorians, but we accept a degree of contradiction in the teachings of Ron Hubbard because there's so much of it. And having been implanted for 36 days with images, which pretty much were images of 1966, you know, the clothes, not that, you know, the DC-8 aeroplane, you even have a steam train in there. The crucifixion is implanted at this time. It's all made up. And this is going to control you for all eternity. You've now been implanted so that you're packaged up with who knows how many thousands or millions of body thetans, you know, blown up in this incident. And they're all influencing the way you think. So it's no wonder that humanity is crazy, is it, really, when you think about it? This gets to a point at the end of the incident where the pilot, whoever that is, says he's mucking it up. And that's the last moment of the incident. You're meant to run through that. And then you're meant to go back to incident 1. And this is the entry to the universe. There is some discussion about the dating of this in later issues on the OT5 material. Hubbard said that the entry point was 1.25 quadrillion years ago. Now, a quadrillion is a mixture between a million and a quadrille, which is a kind of dance that goes on for an incredibly long time. You know, so it's million, billion, trillion.
Quadrillion.
And we're not going to get to quintillion or sextillion or septillion or octillion or nonillion. We're not going to mention those.
But
that would be silly.
You're running this on an e-meter, yeah?
Yes, with your cans in one hand, with a little separator between them. It's solo audited, OT3 and OT7, clearing,
of
course.
Watching the e-meter yourself and
getting your little body thetans to uncluster themselves, running them through these incidents very rapidly. I met a guy who had been, he started the OT3 in 1968, aboard the ship under Hubbard's direction. And he was still doing it when I met him in 1983. So he had 15 years of doing this. And he'd got to the point, he was a lovely guy, absolutely lovely guy. He'd stopped working. He'd just, all he did was this. He got to the point where he was in a rooming house with other people who'd aged as he had. He was in his 60s by this time. And his whole focus now was on finding the body thetans that were causing one of the elderly ladies who lived in the house to smell. And he explained this to me in a very matter-of-fact way, that he was going to find the body thetans that caused this smell. I thought it was probably more likely to be bacteria than body thetans, but that could just be, you know, me.
Or is
my
the fact,
view.
was she a Sea Org, an elderly Sea Org member who perhaps didn't have time to, because looping
no, she,
in for Sea Org people.
She was an elderly, you know, I mean, one of the most horrid. I bought a house from, which, and my bedroom in it, my wife's bedroom, had a Sea Org member in it, and it had human fleas. I've never seen them otherwise. I've seen dog and cat fleas, which of course can't live on us. They bite us. The human flea is much bigger. Mm-hmm. And I was so lucky because I bought the house in November and I came away for Christmas wondering what on earth I was going to do about these horrible things. And we switched the heating off over Christmas and the cold killed them. Yes. Much better than the L. Ron Hubbard approach to body thetans, really.
Okay, I was thinking about the another thing that is that the Sea Org members are, how many uniforms are they given? Do they have to purchase them out of their wages? Or
I've talked with a number of Sea Org members who only had a single uniform.
Single uniform that they have.
They're Coast Guard uniforms. They're cheap.
And they're
Coast
judged
uniforms.
And they're judged on the cleanliness of these uniforms, and yet they are not. They're put in a total double bind of not being able to have enough time to launder them, wash them. Or
yeah, only
themselves.
If their statistics have been high at 2 o'clock on a Thursday when statistics are gathered, they may get a Saturday morning off to do laundry.
Two of the first books that I read on Scientology were Mark Headley's Blown for Good and Nancy Manny's My Billion-Year Contract. And both of them had hellish descriptions of the life that these Sea Org people have to lead, where there are lines for the shower, and if you don't get up at 4, you're going to have to stand in a line of like 60 people in order just to get...
And the shower time, Mike Rinder talks about this in A Billion Years, and indeed in the first conversation we had on this channel together. I think he got 30 seconds in the shower or something. It's like
barely enough time to soap up.
And so absolutely despicable. But yeah, so incident one, the first incident, the entry point to the universe, there's a chariot, there's a trumpet sound, and there's a cherub in the chariot. And I have frequently said that one of the reasons that OT3 doesn't work, and the other reason is it's complete nonsense, but one of the reasons is that Scientologists have a misunderstood word on cherub. And anybody who's done OT3, go and look the word up in a dictionary. Doesn't mean a little baby. It's a great big angel. You know?
I'll put up a picture of a cherub on the screen, because I actually do have that from when you've described it before.
Cherubim and seraphim. So anyway, that's what he was doing there. And he went mad. And he just went completely crazy. And he made a call to England. He used to do these trips on his own so he could take whatever drugs he wanted and do whatever he wanted without interruption. He claims, of course, in Ron's journal, 1967, RJ67, that he broke his back doing this. There is no medical evidence to support that idea, but we do think he maybe got so drunk that he fell down and hurt himself at some point.
Wasn't there a motorcycle accident involved?
This is later. This is you're talking about the 70s, yeah. And that's aboard the ship. He made a desperate call to England to have Virginia Downsborough come out to Gran Canaria and rescue him. I interviewed Virginia twice. She was still a believing Scientologist when I interviewed her. And what's more, to my amazement, she was still selling people OT3. Because what she told me was that when she got there, Hubbard was no longer eating. He was no longer drinking. He was living off a shelf full of drugs. I was unfortunately not able to determine from her what was on that shelf, but there will have been amphetamines, barbiturates, and Demerol, which is an opioid. Probably an opiate. Actually, it's probably derived from the poppy. This shelf full of stuff, and he was crazy. She was, you know, he couldn't sleep. He was terrified that the body thetans had taken over, which happened to him again at the end of his life. The account that Serge Faust gave, who was with him towards the end, that he thought the body thetans had taken over. And Virginia Downsborough managed to rescue him. This is the beginning of this organization, this rather long preludium. He said, you know, what was happening was that there were inquiries all over the English-speaking world, in Victoria, Australia, in New South Wales, and what was then Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, now in South Africa, in the Ontario report in Canada. And of course, the British government was just about to launch an inquiry too. These inquiries were very thorough and very negative. I absolutely recommend the Foster report for the British inquiry, because it's irrefutable. He gives you the Ron Hubbard policy letters on fair game and suppressive people and how to harass people and the horrible things you should do to people. And it's all there, chapter and verse. It's not an interpretation. You don't need an interpretation of what these things are saying. Something happened that Hubbard started to feel persecuted, and his existing paranoid tendencies inflamed tremendously at this point. And so he decided that to be safe, he needed to be in international waters where the laws of individual countries would not apply to him and he could do what he wanted. And an incredible change came over Ron Hubbard. OT3 did him a tremendous amount of harm. That set of beliefs took him over and turned him into a tyrant. Talking to people who knew him before, who'd known him in the early 50s, at the early 60s, he was a con artist, no doubt about that. He was charming to some people and odious to others. I've known people who the first time they met him went, oh, he's a disgusting human being. The bad breath from the rotting teeth probably didn't help. But something went wrong in him when he did OT3, and he decided to create the Sea Project, and he invited Virginia Downsborough was the first person invited, and she looked at the state of him and went, no thanks. 19 other people did join up, my good friend Hannah Whitfield being one of them, Neville Chamberlain, not to be confused with Neville Chamberlain, they're two different people. Can you imagine that? You know, your surname is Chamberlain and you have a kid and you think, oh, who's the most popular person in Britain we can name him after? You know, it's like having the surname The Ripper and calling your son Jack. Nev was 16 when he joined up. And so he had this group of people, and originally it's this tiny little thing, but Hubbard is now putting forward this idea that you have to do exactly what you're told. If you're going to be self-determined ever, you need to do exactly what you're told. It's not really working for me, that one, Ron. And people flocked to join the Sea Organization, and the conditions in the Sea Organization were absolutely abysmal from the first. They bought the Avon River, they had the Diana, and they had Royal Scotman, because the registration documents were wrong and it should have been Scotsman, but it was Scotman, which was a cattle ferry, which was never properly made seaworthy, from what I can see. It certainly was not habitable. It was packed with people. And Mike Rinder's description on the first talk I did with him, I was surprised. I've been talking with people about Scientology for 49 years now, and I was shocked by just the stench there must have been in the men's dorm there, and all in the fetid darkness with all of these stinky men who got 30 seconds to shower. I'm sorry.
I was just thinking, did they also have to, as modern people on the free ones have to, hand over their documents, their passports?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Rinder got there in 1973 when he was 18. he'd grown up in Scientology. His parents got him when he was six, and he'd, you know, he'd had a, I think, a relatively normal childhood. You know, he'd gone to a state school, but at 18, having joined the staff in, I think, in Sydney, but in Australia, he was sent out to be trained on the Apollo, and he joined the Apollo and was told that he wouldn't be doing the training because the organization had swapped him for some free courses, and he was, they'd got his passport, he had no money, there was no escape for him. He was a slave.
This is one of the other things that I've heard is the terminology coin, that people are used as coin. You want to dip into that for a second?
I think it's self-explanatory, isn't it? That people have a value and then are traded, just as slaves were traded. I mean, something that perhaps people aren't aware of particularly is that African slaves were worth money, and therefore the mistreatment of them was within the bounds of whether you wanted to destroy what you consider to be property. It's also fair to say that under English law, I'm not sure what American law does with this, women were considered chattels. Wives were chattels, movable goods, their husband. And right into, I think, the 1920s is the last time it happened, a man could sell his wife at the marketplace. And, you know, I mean, I did have that urge a couple of times in my first marriages, but I didn't succumb to it. You know?
I forget an American law, but I do know that it was within my lifetime before women were allowed to have bank accounts of their own.
Look what's happened as a consequence, the banking crash, all of those things.
It's all because us foolish women are allowed to own our money. But the thing is that this Sea Org person is not a person anymore. They are a bunch of workforce that can be traded from org to org. Doesn't matter if you're married, doesn't matter if...
you'll be separated from your spouse.
Yes, you will be separated, and all of a sudden you might find yourself on the opposite end of the planet just because, we need you for this project, or more likely you've peeved off the wrong person, and so they've decided to send you to Upper Canada or Australia. I was also thinking of one of the things that you were saying, the contradiction of, if you want to be self-directed, you have to follow me. If you want to be self-determined, you have to follow me. At least in the Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't have that, because they say free thinking is a sin.
Absolutely. So we can't have any of that.
They get rid of that contradiction. But I think that in Scientology, it's even more insidious because you're being gaslit into believing that you're free, while you've got handcuffs right around your very soul, if you have a soul. But
yeah, it's an absolutely invidious situation that your empathy is harnessed with the idea that you are going to do something immensely positive for the world, and so you must sacrifice yourself to that.
And for the whole agonized future of the planet.
Yeah, the whole agonized future of every man, woman, and child on this planet depends on what we do here and now in Scientology. I think those are the words.
I remember Nora Crest saying she couldn't even take a day off.
I was thinking of Nora too, yeah. Yeah, Nora Beth, yeah.
Because if you take a day off, all of a sudden you are contributing to horrible things. I actually had an experience like that too. I forget what it was I was wanting to do, but my leader sat me down and said, because of your actions, pop, that universe is gone. Pop, that universe is gone. Yeah. Everybody in that universe is now dead because of you.
Bad Spike.
Well, I wasn't Spike then. I was Sophia, I think. I forget. But in the Sea Org, how dare you take a day off because there's too much work. They're not even given time for a breath to think.
I mean, Nora Beth Crest gave a very, very good talk at in Toronto at the Getting Clear of Scientology conference, which we wish people would watch, because I think it remains the most complete dissection of Scientology ever made.
It's rented on Vimeo for less than the cost of a pizza night, folks.
Yeah, let's face it. So please do. And James Beverly needs some money, you know. And I didn't
get
any.
Just the money. Yeah, we don't even get the money. It's
didn't get a. It actually went into debt over Toronto to do that. But we won't get into our detractors. But there's a lot of that in the ex-Scientology world. Like, it's not really surprising.
It's almost like they're soaked in this tub of malice and spite and anger. And it's almost like that's all that you know once you get out. I know that for years I was still, oh no, I have to follow this amount of fear. I have to follow this amount of magical thinking that if I don't do this right thing, I am causing irreparable harm to the universe.
And you did. What can we say? When you look up at the night sky now, so many stars have disappeared because of your bad behavior.
It did lead to me working myself almost literally to death at the nursing home, because I still had this idea that I had to keep working. Well, no, the universe doesn't care if you take an afternoon off to play Minecraft. You can.
The universe doesn't care, full stop. It's like,
yeah.
It's not caring. Yes, I mean, the three principal manipulations in any authoritarian cult group are phobia, guilt, and disgust. I've pushed disgust forward because my colleagues in the field haven't made much of a note of it. But
disgust of disgust of those who aren't doing enough.
Aversion,
who are actually doing quite a bit, are somehow turned into enemies and judged as not having done enough.
And that becomes the aversion that, you know, unhealed former members will project outward to others. And it, you know, it becomes insidious that I look towards redemption. I look towards people getting better. And I accept the idea that if you've been enslaved for decades, you've probably done things that were awful. I mean, let's, you know, elephant in the room, Mike Rinder. That Mike Rinder is currently under attack. And I've investigated this, and I'm quite good at investigating things. that's how Blue Sky came about. It was quite a piece of work. Now I look back on it, hundreds of thousands of documents. And in this case, I've talked with Steve Kinnane, who went through all of the available documents in Australia and did not come up with Mike Rinder's name. I've talked with Steve this week. And I've talked with Carmen Rayner. And it's been put forward that, you know, Mike covered up what happened to Carmen. Carmen's a good friend of mine. We've known each other for 11 years. And in fact, it was Steve Kinnane who begged me to talk with her because she suffered such terrible things. And her brother has been back through the documents relating to her. Mike Rinder's name is not in there. So we have speculation, and I am not going to try and stop anybody from investigating. In fact, I've done a video with Mike, and he agrees with me. If you know anything criminal about Mike Rinder, report it to law enforcement right now.
People forget how compartmentalized Scientology is.
Yeah, you've got hundreds of organizations, and after 1977, because red boxes were taken during the FBI raids, red boxes are material that must be destroyed if there's a raid. The material I have on Charles Manson came out of a red box that came out of, you know, because they panicked and they didn't destroy the material. So now they don't keep records.
Yeah.
So
and one org
they wouldn't be reporting up. There wouldn't be written reports. And, you know, the overwhelming schedule that's placed on people, it makes it, you know, until I see evidence, I am not going to believe. I was in Scientology. I was told lots of things for which there was no evidence. I learned from that experience to say beyond a reasonable doubt, not this sounds right or not, here's some circumstantial evidence or here's some speculation. So,
or even that they're in the same organization. That is, that's another way that they control their staff, is that the org, say Denver's org, they're barely having people in, and yet they're told day after day after day, all the other orgs are booming and straight up and vertical. What the f- is the matter with you? At the same time, somebody in Pittsburgh, who also isn't getting a lot of people in, is being told every other Denver org is booming. So they have, and they have no way of commute, because you can't communicate. You don't have time to communicate. You don't have space to communicate, and you're not allowed to talk about your case on post, so that you can't even natter, complain, you can't have your thoughts, you can't express that there's anything wrong, so that everybody is in a little separate box, all of them thinking that everybody else is doing just fine and they're the only ones who have any trouble. But that also means that if this org over here does something horrible, these guys over here aren't going to hear about it. Or like some people say, where was John Atack? Why didn't John Atack know about
how could it be possible that
England, as a public member, how the holy fuck, I'm going to say it, were you aware of what was happening in, I don't anymore. But in any case, how the holy fuck were you able to know what was happening an ocean and another continent away?
It's the same thought that anybody in America must know what the CIA is doing, because you're American, aren't you? It has been asserted a number of times on our channel that I must have known about the intelligence operations of Scientology. I did not. And as you say, there are compartments. And blame is apportioned. So, you know, one of the great events in Scientology was what's called the Battle of Britain. This is in June 1974, 5 months before I got involved. So I only heard about it much later. But it apparently lost about half the membership in the UK. And a man called Alec Zibersky, who was called Berserksky by many people, was sent to England and set up a marquee at St. Hill, outside St. Hill Manor, and 4 miles out of East Grinstead. And Scientologists it was demanded that they must come. It was so important. And they weren't allowed out of the marquee until they'd signed post-dated checks, what we'll call postulate checks, for amounts of money to go in at a certain time. And a lot of people didn't like that and left. Berserksky was then blamed for this, thrown out, told to sell something like 10,000 copies of Dianetics before he could come back in. And went through what's called an A to E to get back in. What was not said, and I found this out in researching, was that his orders came directly from Diana Hubbard, who was not public punished for what had happened. What I later found out was that her orders came direct from Ron Hubbard. And it's worth remembering the German adage, a fish stinks from the head down. So if you have a super being like Ron Hubbard, who has an organization, I'm afraid you have to look to him if he's not actually making things happen. One of the things that I've worked with is social influence model. And we published it in Opening Our Minds, and indeed the only version of the social influence model approved by its author is the one in the book Opening Our Minds. The author was Professor Emeritus Alan Shefflin, the late and quite remarkable Alan Shefflin. He was a professor of law, and he also had a master's in counseling, and he was very active helping people who'd been manipulated. And he, over the decades, constructed this way of determining how much guilt somebody should bear for what they've done, which I'm currently applying to the Manson. Mansonites, I don't really like calling them the family, because they weren't. Unless they were an incestuous family, of course, you know. But we won't take that apart this moment. But looking at the different members of the family, they had a different degree of responsibility, I have no doubt. And I think the same is true for all of us in all circumstances. And I would say that, yes, you first of all find evidence that proves guilt. which can be an admission on the part of the guilty person, but evidence from witnesses or documents that proves beyond a reasonable doubt the person was guilty. When you've established guilt, you then need to establish mitigation. To what extent were they actually responsible for what they did? In law, this is called actus reus, which is, did they commit the act? And mens rea, did they intend to commit the act? You know, so if somebody was insane, they can't be held responsible. I personally think you should still lock them up if they're doing horrible things, whether they feel whether they're responsible or not. So with former members, there is this balance. Now, at the moment, there are 4,000 slaves in Scientology. What are we doing to help them? Not very much, generally. I have suggested when we put up a video saying why we don't protest, and I think people who agree with protests didn't watch that video. I was quite disappointed that one of the significant figures in the counter-Scientology movement objected to the video and then told me he hadn't watched it. Mm-hmm. Because the video, of course, as you participated in it and edited it, you know very well. We said, this is why we don't do this. And I think that the Sebastian protests on TikTok from LA have proved that you can actually make Scientology more popular by protesting, that it's fine to demonstrate, but you need to look at how can you help these people. And what we suggested there was write to the organization, get an anonymous email, write to the organization, and make contact with an individual there who will be a letter registrar. It's their job to write letters. And just be friendly. You know, don't get choppy and nasty, and ask them about their life. And they have to respond because it's their statistic. How many letters they receive is their most important statistic. So if you keep emailing them, they'll keep communicating with you. And you can ask them about the conditions. You can ask them, you know, why they believe what they believe. You can get them to explain things to you, and you can communicate with them. Standing outside the organization shouting, I'm still not, you know, not sure that actually helps the slaves to reconsider their situation. I think it's frightening. It's off-putting.
I'd also like to add to that just because we might hold this view, and I think we don't, does not mean that we are the enemy.
And that's where we've come to at the moment, isn't it? That we now have two factions fighting each other. Out in the ex-Scientology, or at least two factions, they're independent.
Those people who are going out I just don't agree that that's the best way. But that doesn't mean that I don't hold the utmost respect for them and the feelings that they're having. That hey, this is wrong. We've got to do something. I'm just saying, hey, let's take a look at maybe this. But that does not mean that I'm their enemy or that I don't respect them. And that's another way of enslaving people. And the way that these see it is that they're being told that everybody outside is an enemy. So what's better than a bunch of people holding signs and shouting, which makes, oh my God, there's people protesting us. Oh my God, they're our enemy. Or somebody like, I don't mind the ones who go over and do something positive and go, okay, here, have a water bottle, here, have this, rather than, hey, we just shut down the organization. They're all having their windows shut because they're in protest drill and they're all upset and their stats all go down for the day and they're all cuddled inside, scared of the outsiders, scared of the
and ever more convinced that the outside world is out to attack them, that there is a grand conspiracy to get rid of them. So how do you show friendship? I don't think offering people water is useful, because if they think the water's poisoned, they're not going to take it.
Okay, fair enough. Because I did hear some people who were like offering them because there were these.
No, I think water is free in this country, and it's not a proper gift, you know. And any food stuff may well be tainted. So you offer them kindness. You offer them concern. You don't talk down to them. You don't, you know, try and make yourself seem superior to them. You offer them concern. And if your concern is not genuine, keep away. If you don't want to help these people, if you want to hurt somebody because you hurt, keep away. Get some help. Do something to, you know, make your life better. It, the thing, you know, I hate to say it, but 9 people out of 10 who've approached me over the years to help me in the work I've done, I've turned away because a quick assessment has told me that they want to do harm. They're angry. They want to do harm. They want to hurt somebody. I have never seen such a person help anything. And they create all sorts of messes along the way. So, you know, there are ways of protesting. I mean, I've said this again repeatedly over the years. The whales, forget about the organizations of Scientology. Find out where the whales are. Find out where the people are who are giving huge donations to Scientology. Get into that community. Stand outside their offices and hand out a leaflet. And I wrote such a leaflet. It was used successfully at Chichester and for the Dianetic Bookstore in East Grinstead. We closed them down in weeks. By every time a street recruiter, a body router went out, you'd show them this leaflet and say, the two of us, and you need to do this in pairs, will stay with you all day while you're recruiting. And we will give this leaflet to everybody. And the leaflet, we can make the leaflet available. Scientology sued against it. They sued Richard and Bonnie Woods for handing it out. I'll admit that I wrote it. They, for some reason, didn't go after me. But they handed it out, and ultimately Scientology granted them permission to say whatever they wanted about Scientology. This is within the English court system. So that leaflet by Richard and Bonnie Woods can be handed out in the UK without any legal problems. I don't think there are any legal problems anyway, because what it says is true and palpably so. Mm-hmm. And it gives a description of OT3 in the first paragraph. And that drives the recruiters back in. If you give out a leaflet, if you devise something that explains what Scientology is in a very short form, and just hand it out outside the offices of one of the whales, tell the local newspapers, tell the local officials where the whales are, that this is an organization that is sponsoring slavery, that is paying money to a group that enslaves people. And see how many clients they get after that. Go after the money source. Don't go after upsetting the staff or you know, trying to get media, because media is always good. As Sebastian proved, media can be dreadfully harmful.
Oh yeah.
And I have said this elsewhere. In 1963, when the Victoria Inquiry in Australia began, Kevin Victor Anderson's inquiry, there were about 500 active Scientologists in the world. By 1971, when the last of the government inquiries is produced, there are about 25,000. And the two are correlated. It's not that after 13 years, up to 1963, Hubbard had found out wonderful recruiting methods. It's that the newspapers blared out how sinister and dangerous Scientology was. And a lot of people went, oh, that sounds good to me. You know,
yeah,
like the Alexander Mitchell's stories about Aleister Crowley and Hubbard in 1969. I met so many people who'd got into Scientology because they read those stories. And they go, oh, it's Crowley like magic. I like the sound of that.
Yeah, well, so, also because anything that the mainstream media is saying is bad must be good. There's a certain... However, I also wanted to suggest go to, if you're in the United States, you can complain to our Internal Revenue Service and
Better Business Bureau.
Yeah, our friend
all
Jeff
sorts of places.
Has a form on his site, and I'll link in the description below.
Good.
Saying, giving the form that you can use to complain about Scientology to the Internal Revenue Service to take their tax status away.
Yeah, and but and complain to your political representatives, whether they're members of parliament, senators, congressmen, whatever, representatives, wherever you are. But put the focus over onto the whales. Mm-hmm. These people shout about how much money they've given. You know, Alex Barnes Ross in his protest, you know, they found out some very interesting things and they got the video out, and I don't know where, how that escaped, but we've now have these named people, the patrons of Scientology. They should be protested against because their businesses depend upon people, you know, continuing to give them money. And if you find out that somebody's sponsoring slavery, you know, it's a good headline, isn't it? This company sponsors slavery.
Like ABC Mouse. There's one. Name that right away. I forget the name of the gentleman. I'll probably put it down on the screen. And it was one that got lots of money during the pandemic because all of a sudden everybody's having to homeschool their kids during lockdown. And he made this, and it's probably a good, I don't know, but all of that money, or most of that money, because it's owned by a Scientologist, that means that he has to donate tons, millions of dollars. Not all of it, because some of it's operating whatever and paying his employees and whatever. But
I've seen businesses go bankrupt through gifts to Scientology.
Yeah. Or and you go, a lot of your chiropractic, your veterinary people belong to Sterling Management.
Yeah. Yeah. The World Institute of Scientology Enterprises, WISE or Sterling, anything that's involved with that. Focus on that, on the supply, because money, as L. Ron Hubbard said, the governing policy of Scientology is to make money, to make more money, to make others produce so as to make even more money. Money is the lifeblood. In fact, there was a conversation between Ron Hubbard and the executive director international at the time, Kerry Gleason. And Hubbard said to him, what is the purpose of Scientology, Kerry? And he said, it's to help people. It's to liberate people. And Hubbard said, no, it's to make money. And Kerry said, to make money so that we can help people and liberate people. And Hubbard said, no, it's to make money. And occasionally he was honest. We probably should wrap up, but I'm not trying to stop anybody from investigating anything and reporting it. If you have found something out, we need to be compassionate and considerate. We need to look to redemption. There, you know, I have dealt with a lot of people who've done horrible things to other people, and they've shown remorse, and they've shown contrition. And I believe in forgiveness. I'm not about forgetting anything, but I believe in forgiveness.
And it seems that some people think that they're helping by yelling and screaming at others. Nothing is ever, 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 if anything has taught us anything about what's going on in the Middle East right now, hatred and violence only leads to more hatred and violence. Yoda taught this to us. We should.
Yoda could not English talk despite 800 years old being.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm not going to really go with it, advice from Yoda at this point. But He was a Muppet. He's not real, Spike. Come on, get over it.
No, really?
Yeah, sorry.
But as I was saying, I take a lot of my wisdom from literature. I always have. And one of the things, but also from the world around, and violence and anger only lead, you punch somebody, you yell at them, you scream at them, you divide, all people are going, and it also, it's not a good look. All people, if they're going to, going to look at people who are protesting against Scientology and speaking out against Scientology. And if all they see is a bunch of people going, well, don't watch this channel because they're bad, or this person is awful, and just interfighting. If you have something actually solid, then by all means, bring it to the proper authorities. But if all you've got is suspicion, anger, and yelling.
Keep it to yourself.
Exactly.
And get some help, you know, understand how you have been enslaved by the ideas of Scientology, by this retribution and, you know, the Hubbard way of doing things, put a head on a pike, you know, blame somebody than dealing with your own problems. And of course, again, you know, for the seventh or eighth time in this video, if somebody's guilty of something, then report it to the authorities, you know. Don't just fester. Don't just go round and round in this thing. But to say, you know, think about the 4,000 slaves currently who are being abused on a daily basis and what we can do to help those people. And, you know, which means reporting Scientology, which means, you know, if you bump into somebody and can say, when did you last call your mum? and give them the money for the phone call. If you can take them into a restaurant to eat something so they can be sure you haven't poisoned it, if you can have a conversation with them that is shows concern for their welfare rather than an attack upon them or attack upon Scientology, just don't get into that.
Just hire.
If you care about people, show care. If you don't care about people, keep on screaming. You know, what can I do about that?
I know.
Well, and here we are. So thank you very much indeed, Spike. And thanks to everybody for spending time with us. Please make comments. We will strip out any comments that are abusive. We won't stand for insults. There's no need for it. But anybody that has a point to make, we will try and attend to that. We'll do what we can. But please help people, care about people, have compassion, have empathy. Otherwise, there is no future for humanity if we don't do that. Thank you very much for your time. Cheers, bye.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.